From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Is it okay to humanize hate?
You always want your children to follow in your footsteps, and I would love for my daughter to be the first female Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
A recent documentary series took an in-depth look at families who are part of the KKK. Today, we'll ask where that line is in the media between exposing hate and normalizing. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we want to return to another controversial issue from this Monday, the death penalty. We heard about a new state group called Georgia Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. I spoke with Mark Hyden, who's the group's national advocacy coordinator.
Well, conservatives, by and large, we have a distrust of our government. We don't trust the government to deliver mail, let alone make life and death decisions over American citizens, and that's where the risk is.
Here are your first thoughts. On Twitter, Ted Barfield said he's 90% against the death penalty, but he says there are heinous crimes when there's no doubt of guilt that keep him from being completely against it. And we got this voicemail from a listener who says the death penalty is wrong.
This is Kathleen Stuck, S-T-U-E-C-K. I don't believe in the death penalty because if you kill them, then you have removed their chance for redemption, and we shouldn't do that. Redemption is the message of Jesus Christ, and we should follow that.
We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us like Kathleen did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. There is a renewed effort to revitalize communities in West Atlanta, like The Bluff or Vine City. In the shadow of the new Falcon Stadium, the Blue Seas Restaurant provides healthy, affordable food and also jobs for folks in the neighborhood. But it's more than a restaurant. It also unites Christians, Muslims, and community members all in one place. With me to talk about it is Louis Muhammad, Outreach Coordinator for 10,000 Fearless Men and Women. It's an organization that helped found the restaurant. Hi there, Louis.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
And also with me is Derek Rice, pastor at Sankofa United Church of Christ. Did I say that right, Derek?
Pastor Derek Rice, absolutely.
Hello to you as well.
Hello.
Derek, what exactly is the mission of this restaurant?
Well, the restaurant is an outgrowth of a project that actually started about a year ago after the 20-year anniversary of a Million Man March. Minister Louis Farrakhan suggested that there be 10,000 fearless men and women that would take control of their communities, providing jobs, providing safety, and so forth. And so about a year and a couple months ago now, the 10,000 Fearless Headquarters was birthed. And one of the next steps when we are providing ministry to oppressed communities is to make sure that economics is a part of the equation. And so this business is providing not only nutritious food, but job opportunities and an opportunity to address blight in a community where $2 billion is being spent. But the truth of the matter is not very many residents are benefiting from it.
So, Louis, the 10,000 Fearless Men and Women and this restaurant, is this part of an effort for African Americans specifically?
Yes, because when you look at the community known as The Bluff,
that's the area around Falcon Stadium.
The area around the Falcon Stadium, English Avenue, which is a historic area, Vine City, we know the history of Vine City. It's the home of Dr. King and his family. And so we want to preserve, or do the best we can to preserve the historical factor of these two communities, and the best way to do that is through economic development, because we see the economic blight there and it has to be rebuilt. Just as Pastor Rice said, we have to go back in and effectively rebuild now our communities, and we can do that.
But it's not just African Americans. It's mostly African Americans that live in that community, but not only.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's not only. You're absolutely correct. But I believe it's about 90, almost 95%.
I'm not sure what the percentage is, but I guess the fact that question needs to be asked is it points specifically to the issue. Prior to the $2 billion being planned to be funneled through the community, it was a 100% black community. It became other because we recognize that this is going to be prime real estate. And so the idea, in truth, is to move as many black people out of a community so it becomes a different community from what it has been over the past century. And so the question becomes, as the community is now, do we address by programming, by making sure that we keep these members of the residents of a community a part of the equation, any programming that takes place, we're looking at where we are now. But we recognize that gentrification will make it, could possibly make it such that the African-American community could very easily end up being 30 or 40% of a community because of the planning
that's taking place. Because they'll be priced out of the market.
Exactly.
So why a restaurant, Lewis?
Well, a restaurant was started because, our people are in need in that area for business. And when you look at food consumption in that area, it's not the best. And so with
a lot
the Blue Seas,
a lot of fast food,
and
vegetables.
And the Blue Seas, through its concept with us being part of the Nation of Islam, and nutrition is a key to what we need and what our people need. And also an affordable place where they can get affordable fresh food. This is the where we wanted to start. But we have other ventures that we're planning. I can't go into it right now, but down the line there'll be some other things coming along too that will be helpful to the community. We just don't want to have business for business sake. We want to have business that's going to be helpful to those who are in the community.
This idea of feeding communities, this is one that goes back even to the Black Panthers, who had a large breakfast for families movement, and even
True.
Further than that. What is it about a meal that is so important to social activists?
Well, I mean, there, I believe, are a number of variables in that equation. One, oppressed people, white, black, or otherwise, first want to know that you love them. And one of the most consistent ways to show individuals that I'm here for you is to, on a regular basis, feed you. And so when we recognize that, I think it's worth raising. This area that we're calling the Bluff has the highest incidence of heroin use in the entire country. It has the highest incidence of violence in the state of Georgia. And so this is not just a nice name for a community. And so it's one of the worst communities in the state of Georgia. And here are Christians and Muslims that are coming saying, God is here in the Bluff. Your life does matter. We're feeding you because you want to be a part of a community. And so the first piece before we even get to the nutrition is that we're willing to work with you and not give a 10-foot pole and kind of do ministry to you and for you from a distance. We're becoming a part of a community.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Derek Rice, pastor at Sankofa United Church of Christ, and also with me is Lewis Muhammad, outreach coordinator for 10,000 Fearless Men and Women. So, Lewis, is this restaurant a religious, when you go eat there, is it a religious experience?
Well, you know, religion as defined as a way of life. And so,
if you mean the broad definition
yeah,
of religion.
You, right. If you're, and eating is something that's a way of life.
Yeah.
And so, yes, in that aspect it is, but no, I mean, whatever.
Nobody's making you
it's not prayer, persuasion, whatever. We just want you to come by and have a nutritious meal, just like Pastor Rice says. You know, that's one of the first principles that the Christians who and Muslims who follow the teachings of Jesus, you know, he said to Peter, if you love me, feed my people. And so that's the concept of it, but it's not a particular religion type thing that you come in because you're a Muslim or a Christian. No, we have many who come in who don't even profess a quote unquote religion.
So how is the restaurant doing?
It's doing great. Everywhere I go to a lot of community meetings around the city and in that area, and countless people come up to me all the time and thank us for coming in. They thank us for the nutritious meal. They thank us that they can come somewhere and get some good vegetables, you know, not a fast food concept, as you mentioned. So, yes, we are growing in leaps and bounds, and we look to grow even further.
Do you have numbers, like the number of people who've dined there?
I don't have numbers specifically with me, but, I mean, we're got people, it was particularly lunchtime, a lot of people coming in. Through the lunch experience, a lot of calls we get in. We get a lot of orders that are called out. So I can't remember who the number.
The writer of the Creative Loafing article was, but he opens his article by saying, given my regular steady seeing of the steady stream of customers in the restaurant, I wanted to come to see what the Blue Seas restaurant was about. And so the reporting suggests that there's a regular stream, particularly during the lunch hours of residents and supporters of a restaurant.
Yes.
And give me an example. By the way, the writer of that was Jeff Davis. But okay. Give me an example of a menu. What if I go to the Blue Seas, what do I eat?
Well, we have, there's some good squash. There's some good zucchini, cabbage, macaroni and cheese. And then there's some very good baked chicken, as well as fish. And you can order off the menu, like if you wanted some fish tacos, you could order that off of the menu. There's some good carrots. And so that's basically, that's because it's a hot bar. It's like when you walk in a buffet, but it's not a buffet style, but you can order off of that hot bar. So you don't even necessarily have to wait a whole long time to get your food. You walk in and you like what you see, you just pick out what you want, it's served up to you, and then you can eat there, or you can take it away with you.
Derek, you were talking about some of the challenges that face this particular neighborhood. Is this effort a sign that you don't, either you don't trust or you don't want to wait for the government to protect the residents?
Well, as a Christian minister, I think that the blueprint has already been laid. I mean, so when Jesus is born, the prophecy says that unto us a child is born and the government will be laid on his shoulders. And for those of us who particularly just came out of the Advent season, one of the pieces that I think is interesting that we miss is here's a government that says you, for tax purposes, have to leave a town you live in to go to another town to be counted so that we can raise the taxes and get money. The government has always had a focus. Ministry has always had a focus. And so I don't know that I'm willing to say that I trust or don't trust or that I'm waiting or not waiting. As a minister, we have work to do. And yes, the work is to set captives free, bring recovery of sight to the blind, fight for oppressed people. And if a government gives the gravy to make it easier work, that's good. But I'll let you kind of just kind of look back in history and see how many times the government has pulled oppressed communities from the gutter. Doesn't happen on a regular basis. There's usually a remnant of individuals that push, and once the work gets started, there's some supplemental assistance that takes place. So I believe what we're doing is doing just what gets us here to the studio. Someone is noticing that good work is being done. It will be broadcast, and then individuals will then say, perhaps we should help to support that so that it expands. And so I think we're taking the first steps that will, by default, make the work grow. In fact, we're looking at starting another 10,000 Fearless House as we speak because the work is such good work. And so I just think that when the first good steps are taken, people take notice, and it gives the gas to expand the work.
Yes.
We have about 30 seconds left. Lewis, did you want to answer that same question?
Well, yes. And as Pastor Rice says, that's what the initiative is. And as people saw us go out in the community, they saw Christians and Muslims working together. It became a blueprint now that's happening not just here in Atlanta, but I believe in 98 other cities across the country. This is happening, and it's going to catch on because we cannot wait for government. We have enough resources among our own selves in our own communities to clean it up and to make it go right.
That is Lewis Muhammad, Outreach Coordinator for 10,000 Fearless Men and Women. Also Derek Rice, pastor at Sankofa United Church of Christ. They helped found the Blue Seas Restaurant in the West Atlanta neighborhood. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Last month, the A&E Network canceled a documentary series about the KKK. The series featured Klan members in North Georgia. It was scrapped because it turns out some of the people interviewed were actually paid to appear. The series was called Generation KKK, but that title was changed to Escaping the KKK, a documentary series exposing hate in America. The title change was a response to criticism that the series crossed an ethical line between exposing hate and normalizing it. And we wondered, where exactly is that line? We have ProPublica reporter Jessica Hoosman, who's part of the team behind the Documenting Hate project with us. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much.
Also with us is filmmaker Michael Ramsdell, who used to live in Atlanta, and now he joins us by Skype from Howell, Michigan. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And also with us is Betsy Graba. She's an associate dean and professor in the media school at Indiana University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So one of the reasons that we're speaking with you, Michael, is because you actually created a documentary on this subject called The Anatomy of Hate. What was the thought behind your documentary series?
The thought behind my documentary series was exploring what is this thing that we call hate. And it seems to be a fairly subjective line that moves with the cultural climate. Is this hate? Is that hate? So I was looking to use the social sciences as maybe a little bit different paradigm to look at the whole idea and see if we couldn't find a more conclusive or a better foundation with which to understand it.
Did you come up with a definition? Because we have one. The one that the definition of a hate group is the one that people often default to was given to us by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Did you find a different definition?
I did. And I have great respect for the Southern Poverty Law Center. But yes, I disagree with them. There's the only definition I ever heard of hate that I can subscribe to is anything that separates me from my fellow man is hate. In which case, we're all a little bit guilty of that. Now, the line with which that crosses, you know, that's where it becomes subjective. And so the root cause that I think, you know, that I uncovered in every case is just some form of manifested fear run amok. And so between those two things, recognizing that a separation between self and other and filling that void with fear is where what I believe we come up with the acts that we call today hate.
Okay, so then let me go to you, Betsy, because what is the academic description of hate group? In other words, if I'm a reporter and I want to label someone as belonging to a hate group, how do I measure that?
Yeah, I think this is where we need to go back to the First Amendment and think about hate speech and when we cross the line into threatening speech. And that is probably not something that the media ought to offer a platform to. But I think we'll do very well here today if we can uncoil and untease a little bit some of the assumptions that underlie not giving a voice to so-called hate groups. And the one thing that strikes me that's problematic is the assumption that no coverage would somehow take hate groups away, that they would cease to exist and that they would have no voice. And we know in a current media environment that is just not realistic. That will not happen. And the second thing that I think is problematic is the assumption that somehow coverage would promote a cause. And I would say there's faulty logic behind that. I mean, and it would be similar to argue that covering unemployment would make people not want to work. It's not a logical assumption to build an argument against coverage of hate groups. Okay. In fact, the media have a responsibility to go into dark corners, uncomfortable corners,
and that leads
messy
us to,
corners.
Yeah, that leads us to Jessica, who's that's her job at this point. But let's hear a clip from the now canceled A&E documentary series about the KKK. This clip features the voice of Steve Howard. He is an imperial wizard in North Mississippi White Knights.
As far as I know, I'm the youngest imperial wizard that ever leads the clan. I'm 34 years old. As the CEO of the company, to be an imperial wizard, that is the boss man. I want to be the next David Duke. I want to see him saying my name at presidential debates.
So, Jessica, this effort at ProPublica is called Documenting Hate. Is the impetus behind this the recent growth in hate groups like the KKK?
You know, I think that is certainly part of it. But our direct impetus was that during when everybody was claiming that there was such a large rise in hate crimes, we realized very quickly, and it's something that we've known for a long time, but I think it was just sort of brought into new life that no one actually knows how many hate crimes are committed. So it's very difficult to say with any certainty that there is a spike or there isn't a spike. Anecdotally, I think everybody agrees that there is. But there is no national organization that is doing a good job tracking hate crimes, including the FBI. And so, you know, the FBI tracks a few thousand hate crimes every year, but the Bureau of Justice Statistics surveys on victimization indicate that there are about 250,000 hate crimes every year. So there's a huge difference between what is actually happening and what we know about. And so our idea was that we would set up a better system of tracking hate crimes and alerting the media to them in such a way that they can be covered in the scope and scale that they're actually happening in, rather than the distorted numbers that we have.
I want to mention that we did reach out to the executive producer of that A&E documentary series now called Escaping the KKK. He did not get back to us for comment. So let me get back to you, Michael, and your opinion on this debate over this documentary. One of the main reasons the documentary was canceled, because it turns out that the filmmaker paid some of the people who appeared in that. But other than that, because you made a documentary on this topic, it seems like you would think that making a documentary about members of the KKK would not be normalizing that. Is that a safe assumption?
That's absolutely a safe assumption. And normalizing is very different than humanizing. You know, what I was, the word we were using earlier is that it's inappropriate to humanize those in hate groups. And I have a big issue with that, because I think the opposite of humanizing them is dehumanizing them. And that's exactly the reason why, you know, we find them so detrimental to a productive society, is because they dehumanize others. So for us to take that same approach and dehumanize them, or choose not to humanize them, is committing the same crime. And so I think it's incredibly important. Albert Einstein has the great saying that peace can only be achieved through understanding. And if you're going to, as a journalist or a filmmaker, take an honest look, and that was my intention the whole time, is to truly try to understand what it is that motivates people or draws people to these ideologies and these acts, only through that kind of true understanding, and only through honestly trying to find some kind of empathetic connection to the human condition that we all share, can you really begin to understand it? And then through understanding it, that's where you can come up with productive resolutions. Because if they are just quote unquote evil or dehumanized or some lesser form, then we're casting the same aspersions on them. And that leads to a very unproductive dialogue.
Okay. So, Betsy, let's talk about something which was in the news just within the past week. White nationalist Richard Spencer was the one who coined this term alt-right. He has gotten a lot of media attention. Here is a little taste of his speech he was giving to a large crowd that was part of a recent documentary produced by The Atlantic.
For us as Europeans, it is only normal again when we are great again. Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
So, Betsy, one of the arguments going on among journalists right now is whether to use this term alt-right, or whether to just simply call them white supremacists or white nationalists. What do you think?
I think it might be in the best interest of public debate to avoid labels altogether, but to call organizations by the names that they give themselves, and let those names stand for themselves. I do think that that Michael has made a very important point, that it is the dehumanization of groups through labels and name calling that perhaps contribute to the polarization that we now experience in this country. So I think further name calling might not achieve a productive debate, and would not advance a state where citizens can evaluate for themselves who these hate groups are and how they affiliate or not with them.
Jessica, what do you think? You're a journalist. You are working for ProPublica on this Documenting Hate. Do you think that ProPublica will use the term alt-right, or will they use white supremacist?
We will not use alt-right. We have had a discussion. We've had several discussions about this in the newsroom. I mean, what alternative right stands for is alternative right. It is being presented to the public as an alternative to what is happening now. In a sense, they are attempting to normalize themselves. And I don't think that that should be allowed. I completely disagree with the idea that we should allow groups to call themselves whatever they want, because in a way that allows them so much power over the conversation, over how they are portrayed, over how they are perceived by people. There's a split in the alt-right community right now around, you know, who's a Nazi and who's just trying to provide a new path forward for far-right people. I think the name is even confusing to people within the alt-right community.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second, because what you've said actually came up during this incident with Richard Spencer, the white supremacist. He was being interviewed on a street in D.C. Just after Donald Trump's inauguration. He was talking to a reporter from Australian Public Television, and he was punched on camera, and he was talking about this very thing you just mentioned.
Neo-Nazis don't love me. They kind of hate me, actually.
The KKK neo-Nazis.
Hey, those people don't like me,
to be
honest.
Are you like the hipster version of the neo-Nazi movement?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Okay, so that sound at the end, Michael, was Richard Spencer getting punched in the face. This has raised a debate between people of whether or not it's okay to punch someone because they're a white supremacist and therefore their views include damage to other races. What do you think of this debate?
I mean, yeah, I think that the evidence is pretty clear on that. I mean, I'm a big believer in self-defense and that everybody has the right to defend themselves. But if violence was the answer and killing people or punching people or going to war was the answer, then we would have been at peace a long time ago, because we've been running down that path for as long as human beings have existed. And it is just not productive. I try to move the conversation out of the issues of right and wrong, because that's, again, a very subjective line. But if the objective is to create a world of peace and prosperity for all, there is just no place for violence in that. And I get that tensions run high. I get that anger and frustration. But we are a creature with immense intellectual capabilities. And if we are going to defend the idea that the betterment, the better angels of ourselves are what should prevail, then resorting to sucker punching somebody in the face is about as low on that scale as you can get. So no, I have no empathy, support, or any kind of acknowledgement that violence is the right way to go down these paths.
So Jessica, our main question here is how journalists can responsibly cover hate groups without humanizing them or normalizing them. And so far, the suggestions have been to not allow them to make threats on the air. That's obvious. But that's difficult to do if you're talking to them live. You can't control mm-hmm. what they're going to say. There's also a suggestion of what we should use to label them. What are your thoughts on this? What are your guiding principles in terms of covering hate groups, the KKK and many others, without humanizing them?
Right. So, you know, I think that it's important to note from the onset that I have a little bit of a different perspective on this than perhaps some other people in this conversation, because writing about things in the news is very different from a documentary on the subjects. You know, I don't have 90 minutes or 2 hours to paint a full picture. At best, I've got 2,000 words on a really good day. And so I think that it's important to note that journalists cannot tell the whole story. We cannot both humanize the person who is causing harm and humanize the victims and explain it in historical context. We have to pick. And I think what has been most troubling to me as I have watched other journalists cover hate groups, the alt-right, quote unquote, specifically, who I will just refer to as white supremacists, because they do not put these people in historical context. There was this wave of coverage, for example, of Richard Spencer's movement, in which everyone came out and pretended as if it were completely new that white supremacists were well-dressed and well-educated and spoke well. There is this common misperception that what white supremacy looks like is people in Georgia and the backwoods of Louisiana running around in pointy white hats, and that has historically not been true. Otherwise, you would not have some of the laws that were on the books today and several decades ago. People who are not in power do not create laws and if we did not have powerful intellectual or at least well-educated white supremacists, then those laws never would have been on the books. So I think that it's important for journalists to first understand historical context of white supremacy themselves, and then also find a way to translate that succinctly to readers. I think that it is more important for people who have a limited word count, who have to fit words on a page, or at least hold the attention of an online audience for long enough to relay a message, to prioritize the harm that these folks are causing, to prioritize the historical context in which they live,
and
rather
that
than
can
humanizing
be difficult.
Them as people.
Yeah, in a short period of time. That's ProPublica reporter Jessica Huseman, documentary filmmaker Michael Ramsdell, and Indiana University professor Betsy Graba. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Storms in South Georgia have devastated the communities there in the last few days. Since the storms began this past weekend, at least 15 people have been killed. Dozens more have been injured, along with a lot of property damage. GPB's Grant Blankenship was in Albany earlier this week covering the damage, and he joins me now from Macon. Hi there, Grant.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Could you start by giving us an update on the estimation of the damage and injury to life and limb?
Well, that's a two-part answer. The thing you have to remember about Albany is that they did this with a tornado only on January 2nd. And so the estimates of property loss for that first storm were up around $100 million. That was before what happened last weekend. And I believe that the estimates for this storm are about in the same neighborhood, about $100 million. I do know that as recently as yesterday afternoon, there were still search and rescue efforts underway in Albany. There was a two-year-old boy who was being looked for. He ran out of his trailer home in the middle of the storm, and his parents haven't seen him since. So those efforts are continuing. People are still being sought after, looked for, recovered from the debris.
Is coming from either the state or possibly the federal government?
Well, you know, Chris Gohalis, chairman of the Doherty County Commission there in Albany, has literally been pleading for help from FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, since that first storm on January 2nd. Yesterday afternoon, Governor Deal announced publicly that FEMA aid was coming in response to the request he made after that first storm, only to then retract that statement. So FEMA is not on the ground yet. That request has been made now to two presidents. President Obama received the request after the first storm. President Trump now has that request and the expedited request that the governor issued for the damage in Albany and Adel yesterday. But so far, nothing from the federal government. I do know that GEMA, Georgia Emergency Management, is on the ground with emergency responders in Albany offering aid, advice, manpower.
Right.
But federal aid is not there yet.
In the minute that we have left, let's actually hear from people affected by the storms. This is Gloria Gaines, District 5 County Commissioner, displaced from her home, like many of her constituents.
I have sustained damage to my house. My neighbors have trees in their houses. We cannot enter. We have to come in the back way because the power line is down. We just have to be careful of those power lines.
What are the most urgent needs that you're hearing, at least, that or heard from people there?
Well, right now, the most urgent need is to get trees off of houses. One of the peculiarities of disasters like this is that public workers can't go on your private property to get the tree off your house. That has to be done by an outside contractor. That can run into the thousands of dollars out of pocket for people. And in a city like Albany, where, 30% of the people live below the poverty line, that could really set people back. So a lot of the volunteer effort on the ground in Albany is just people who have chainsaws and ATVs trying to get back into neighborhoods to get the trees off of people's houses and cars.
That is GPB's Grant Blankenship. He has been covering the storms in South Georgia this past week. Thank you so much, Grant.
Hey, my pleasure.
While the TV and film and music industries in Georgia have seen documented growth, video gaming is also on the rise here. The industry has experienced a substantial surge and possibly positions Georgia to be an emerging hub for gaming. Joining me to talk about this is Asante Bradford, Project Manager of Digital Entertainment and Emerging Media for the Georgia Department of Economic and Development. Asante, that is a long title. So what does digital entertainment seems clear, but let's start there. What is included in digital entertainment?
Well, mostly I focus on, I would say, industries that are focused a lot on the internet. So when you're talking about like gaming, animation, digital video, now virtual reality.
And so how is that different from emerging media?
Right. Pretty much every year there, or even a little shorter than that term, there's always something new coming out in digital entertainment. And so for that, I think for the title, basically be able to cover kind of what's coming, what's new. And I want to give the state a lot of credit because we recognize that, you know, these industries, especially for a lot of the millennials and things coming up, they've grown up on a lot of these things. So as they continue to grow and evolve, you know, the state of Georgia will be there and continue to be involved in these new technologies and new entertainment sources.
Okay, but how does one do that? Let me give some context to that question, because I believe the esports industry has now or is very close to being $1 billion a year in value. We've seen stories of professional athletes buying esports teams. It's clearly a growing industry and is clearly going to be valuable in the years ahead. But it also can be done from anywhere, right? You can create an esports network and do this work from anywhere in the nation. So how does Georgia actually position itself to attract this industry?
Good question. Well, again, esports is a little bit more than just the online portals and stuff. You're talking about like a Twitch or something like that, because you actually have events. So these events is great for the state of Georgia, is because also there's a tourism aspect to that as well. So when you're talking about 30, 40,000 people coming and filling a stadium or arena, you get the tourism aspect, which is a great part of it. And then you're right, we also get in part with the broadcasting part. And I think with Georgia, what's going on right now, especially with a lot of the young talent that we have, they're already, you know, using Twitch, YouTube, and a lot of these things.
I want to stop for just a moment and sure. Explain for those who don't recognize the name Twitch. That is a live streaming platform. And also, I think it's fair to say, a social community where people can go and watch. They often watch these esports events, and you can also watch gamers live stream as they play.
Reckless, he's got a massive turnaround in his hand. Oh, there goes Damsu. Shut down, gold in his pocket. Towns is melting. Freddy's going down.
Okay, proceed.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so Twitch TV is basically an online platform for gamers and non-gamers. Again, if you just want to watch people play games and actually learn how to play the game better. So they have what's called Twitch broadcasters as well. So you have actually like a sports broadcast. You actually have broadcasters who are actually talking about the action taking place.
That is a nice peek from Flamey. And all on all of Meister. You never want to say it's impossible, but again, now we would have to make some huge mistakes here to let go of this round.
And he's not wasting any time. Look at that. He's just running straight up slope. He wants to get onto that site. Mid-air headshot on Guardian.
And again, right, they're talking about the players. And then, right, the whole player aspect. So, yeah, Twitch TV was bought by Amazon a couple years ago and, you know, billion-dollar company now and doing very well. But also transitioning right now to, I think, what you said as well, a lot of the esports companies are looking at building their own portals and doing their own broadcasts on their own networks. So that's kind of an evolving scene right now. But Twitch TV really helped put the whole esports scene on the map.
I want to, again, make sure we're not leaving anybody behind. Because for many people, when I say esports, they might immediately think Madden. Right? An actual game that is sports. That is not what esports means. And for example, there are a number of NBA team owners and athletes that have bought professional esports team. When we say esports, what exactly are we talking about here?
Competitive gaming for teams.
So that don't have to be games surrounded around sports.
No, not at all. No, actually, those are actually probably the lowest attended, but no, mostly multiplayer type games where teams can compete against each other. So even if you look at League of Legends, which people probably don't know, but a Call of Duty or something like that, where you have a team of, let's say, friends, of 5 to 7 friends, you know, you can actually compete against other teams for prizes. And we're talking big prize money. And you're right, they're talking about the sports teams now getting involved. they basically have the infrastructure to handle these type of teams. So that's what's really exciting to see them moving into the sport. But no, esports has really, when you talk about, it's not really even tied into sports.
Yeah.
It's more about competition. So I think you nailed that.
Okay, so let me go back to this idea of how Georgia creates a niche for itself in this particular area. One thing at which Georgia is not particularly good is retaining our young talent. We bring in a lot of people who go to our universities and graduate and then leave. But it would seem to me that in order to become a leader in this field, we're going to have to keep some of those people here in Georgia. So how do we do that?
Great question. And the trend is actually changing on that, which is really exciting. So my actually position was created because of that. That's why I have
that
to give the state
problem.
A lot of credit for recognizing that what you're saying is absolutely true. That a lot of our young talent, we do the Hope Scholarship, and all of a sudden they leave as soon as they graduate.
Yeah.
So my job is actually recruiting those companies to come here and hopefully retain that talent. Now what we're seeing, again, more in the game development side, is when I started, we had 3 to 5 game companies. Now we have over 110 game companies in the state. And a lot of that is because of this young talent deciding to forego going to California, New York, or Texas. And now, like, hey, let me create my own game or create my own app. The same thing I think could happen in the esports place as well, because there's still going to be development. We have a company called Hi-Rez, and obviously we know about Turner doing the tournaments, but Hi-Rez has 3 games that they're developing for the esports community, and they are doing very, very well, and actually probably have put us on the map because of their international relationships. So, again, now the young talent is now seeing these opportunities. So I think the job for us is still continually education, because you're right, these are new things. Esports is really new to the United States. It's been out a while, but really new here. And Atlanta can actually be a player, because it ties into the whole entertainment scene, because you're talking a lot of correlation between film, television, and now with esports, you're looking at some of the same components. So now we're, again, retaining a lot of the talent on those sides, on the film and television. Again, the same thing. Now we're seeing curriculum created in our colleges that are actually pointed toward these type of opportunities, job opportunities when they get out. So as long as these talent keeps getting educated and they keep learning these programs, we're pretty confident that they're going to stay in Atlanta because of the big selling points about Georgia being cost of living, cost of doing business, tax credits, and this young talent that is now staying here. So we're actually getting a lot of outside interest from even outside the country now, because they're seeing that this young talent, especially in the Southeast, you know, we're becoming a pretty good hub for that. And as long as our colleges, again, keep, you know, working with these esports companies and working with the game developers and developing these curriculums, I feel pretty confident that that number will continue trending downward.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Asante Bradford. He is the project manager of digital entertainment and emerging media at the Georgia Department of Economic Development. Now, you mentioned League of Legends earlier. You said you didn't know if people would know that. I would assume most people have at least heard of it. I think it has something like 70 million players per month. That's what's called a MOBA, which stands for Multiplayer Online Battle Arena. I think I got that right. The reason I bring that up is because there is a championship game that Riot Games, the maker of League of Legends, does every year. And it's located in Los Angeles and Berlin. And it attracts a huge number of people. The prize money is like $1 million. It gets tens of millions of viewers online. When will Atlanta have that kind of event here? Because in order to move forward in esports, and please correct me, I'm not the expert, it would seem to me that we need to have that kind of championship game here.
I would agree. And I think we're trending in the right way in that kind of in that space because of the, I don't say notoriety, but of course the more the marketing publicity that's going on with our other tournaments that are here. So it's going to be a big year, and we've already had a big year. Hi-Rez had a $1 million tournament last weekend. Of course, we know Turner E-League has their big tournament this weekend. We have Major League Gaming coming in next month. We have DreamHack that's doing their first U.S. tournament, which is a European company coming here in the summer. So I think as long as we continue doing that, and I think, again, it's more of an educational thing, as people are saying that Atlanta's a great place for this opportunity. But I also see a lot of correlation between the film industry as well, with now we're seeing all of these studios that are popping up. We're going to need the same thing in esports to grow to what you're saying. So we need facilities, and yeah. I know there are a couple that are actually hopefully happening this year where you could have a space for these players to come in and practice, come in and do tournaments every week. That's what I think it's going to take for us to get to that level.
Okay, so then let's talk about the other issue which could possibly be involved, which is the debate over gambling related mm-hmm. to esports. And this is obviously a debate that's coming to Georgia anyway, because there's casinos that want to build here. But what is your view and the state's view on whether or not people should be allowed to gamble on esports?
I do agree with you. We're seeing that real big growth, especially in Nevada, and that's pretty much who we will be competing with on that level right now, because they've had a little head start and they've been doing it. You're right. If that happens here, I'm sure I will be getting a lot of calls from companies who would be interested in coming here.
Yeah.
I just basically wait and see what happens. The same with the tax credits. I work with what I'm giving.
Asante Bradford is the project manager of digital entertainment and emerging media at the Georgia Department of Economic Development. Before you go, Asante, what game do you play?
I'm a sports guy. So Madden, NBA, boxing, I like the sports games.
Nobody wants to watch you play those, though.
I know, right? And I'm not good enough to win any big money or anything like that. So, and then mobile games. So, yeah, I play all type of different mobile games as well.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Oh, thank you. You too.
The E-League Counter-Strike Major Tournament began earlier this week at the Fox Theater. It wraps up this weekend with the grand finals on Sunday. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. Do you play an online game, and would you actually watch other people play it as well? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.